This is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. President Bill Clinton will return to center stage tonight. He's preparing to take on the Republicans in his speech when he formally places President Barack Obama into nomination. We're working our way to that event. Meantime, we've heard from members of Congress, the president of the United Auto Workers, and with one of the biggest ovations of the night, Sister Simone Campbell, who delivered an impassioned attack on the Paul Ryan budget. Coming up now, Sandra Fluck. She's a Georgetown Law School graduate. She testified in February before the House Democratic Steering and Policy Committee about the importance of insurance coverage for contraception. That put her into the national spotlight. Talk show host Rush Limbaugh called her a slut, and President Obama called her to express his support. Sandra Fluck now at the Democratic Convention.
Some of you may remember that earlier this year, Republicans shut me out of a hearing on contraception. In fact, on that panel, they didn't hear from a single woman. Even though they were debating an issue that affects nearly every woman. Because it happened in Congress, people noticed. But it happens all the time. Too many women are shut out and silenced. So while I'm honored to be standing at this podium, it easily could have been any one of you. I'm here because I spoke out. And this November, each of us must speak out. During this campaign, we've heard about two profoundly different futures that could await women in this country, and how one of those futures looks like an offensive, obsolete relic of our past. Warnings of that future are not distractions. They are not imagined. That future could become real. In that America, your new president could be a man who stands by when a public figure tries to silence a private citizen with hateful slurs. A man who won't stand up to those slurs or to any of the extreme bigoted voices in his own party. It would be an America in which you have a new vice president who co-sponsored a bill that would allow pregnant women to die preventable deaths in our emergency rooms. An America in which states humiliate women by forcing us to endure invasive ultrasounds that we don't want, and our doctors say that we don't need. An America in which access to birth control is controlled by people who will never use it. An America in which politicians redefine rape and victims are victimized all over again. In which someone decides which domestic violence victims deserves access to services and which don't. We know what this America would look like. And in a few short months, that's the America that we could be. But that's not the America that we should be, and it's not who we are. We've also seen another America that we could choose. In that America, we'd have the right to choose. It's an America in which no one can charge us more than men for the exact same health insurance. In which no one can deny us affordable access to the cancer screenings that could save our lives. In which we decide when to start our families. An America in which our president, when he hears that a young woman has been verbally attacked, thinks of his daughters, not his delegates or his donors. And in which our president stands with all women and strangers, come together and reach out and lift her up. And then, instead of trying to silence her, you invite me here. And you give me this microphone to amplify our voice. That's the difference. Over the last 6 months, I've seen what these two futures look like. And 6 months from now, we're all going to be living in one future or the other, but only one. A country where our president either has our back or turns his back. A country that honors our foremothers by moving us forward, or one that forces our generation to refight battles that they already won. A country where we mean it when we talk about personal freedom. Or one where that freedom doesn't apply to our bodies or to our voices. We talk often about choice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's now time to choose.
And that was Sandra Fluke, the Georgetown Law School graduate who became a subject of national discussion when she was criticized by Rush Limbaugh and President Obama came to her defense. She talked about two different Americas. We could have a president who has women's back or turns his back on them. And she got a rousing ovation there in Charlotte. NPR's Debbie Elliott is on the floor of the convention. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm in the Ohio delegation where a lot of the women here were holding up signs that said, "Our health care choice, vote." And I'm sitting with Michelle Mills. She's a city council member from Columbus, Ohio, also a delegate. And she looked over at me during Sandra Fluke's speech and said, "Awesome." What was the message from her that really resonated with you?
What resonates with me is that we should not be silent when there are issues that we need to speak up for, including controversial issues, whether it means laying ourselves in front of an issue that's important. It's going to last from generation to generation. What also resonated is that we were here to listen to her, and she has the voice to carry for all of us and for all of the girls who need all of the things that are in the Affordable Health Care Act. And the other thing that I want to make sure that I mention is that all of the reactions to her comments are short-sighted, because it's not just about having the ability to have sex. It is about interconceptual care, because that is about spacing. That allows women's bodies to recover after pregnancy, and contraception helps with that. That allows us to reduce the numbers of infant mortality. That is what is in the Affordable Health Care Act, and not the short-sightedness about someone having sex after a party.
You know, both Ohio is very important in this election, and women are very important in this issue. As a woman, you told me earlier that you're very frustrated with the efforts of others to define you. Talk to me about that.
Right, the negotiability about what happens to us, particularly when we talk about traumatic events such as rape, that somebody gets to define and have a conversation. We don't have a conversation about when or if issues happen with someone having prostate cancer or Viagra. There's not as many discussions about that as there are about women's health care.
Well, thank you for speaking with
thank
me.
Thank you.
Back to you, Jennifer.
Thank you, NPR's Debbie Elliott. We're going to go down to the podium now in Charlotte. We're listening to Jim Sinegal. He's the former CEO of Costco.
We're proud that Costco pays the highest wages among our peers, that we provide benefit and health care packages that are second to none. And just as importantly, that we've grown our business by promoting from within. so that we're not just giving Costco people jobs, we're empowering them to build careers and support middle-class families. At Costco, we know a thing or two about what it takes for business to succeed, for a company to do well by its shareholders and do the right thing for its employees at the same time. We don't want one set of rules for ourselves and another for our employees. We remember back when it was what it was like to be an employee. And that's why we want to be part of an economy built to last. Some of my friends in corporate America say that they need a government that gets off the backs of businesses. And that's why many of them are supporting the opposition with donations of hundreds of thousands of dollars. But I think they've got it all wrong. Business needs a president who has covered the backs of businesses, a president who understands what the private sector needs to succeed, a president who takes the long view and makes the tough decisions. And that's why I'm here tonight supporting President Obama, a president making an economy built to last. See, in order for companies like Costco to invest, grow, hire, and flourish, the conditions have to be right. That requires something from all of us. And if you ask the innovative growth companies across the country, they'll tell you exactly what that something is. They'll tell you America needs to be a nation with the best education system so that workers can get the training they need to join or stay in the middle class. America also needs to be a nation that spurs research and innovation so that our products and industries of tomorrow are invented here at home. America needs to be a nation with an affordable energy of all kinds so companies can keep their costs down and their production lines humming and their products moving. America also needs to be a nation with the safest, most efficient transportation systems so people can and goods can connect with opportunities and markets. America needs to be a nation that pays down its debt in a balanced way so businesses have a predictable environment in which to plan, invest, and to trade. America needs to be a nation with a sensible immigration laws. Laws that are humane.
We've been listening to Jim Senegal, the former CEO of Costco. NPR's Ron Elving joins us now with Matt Continente and E.J. Dionne. Elizabeth Warren is coming up. Ron, tell us why she's become a rising star in the Democratic Party.
Elizabeth Warren symbolizes for the Democrats the effort that was made with the financial system to reform it, to rein it in, to restore some of the regulations that had been taken apart over the last 10, 15, really 30 years. And as a result, she was going to be the person who was going to head up the first consumer protection agency, but she was denied that by Senate Republicans. So she is now running as the Democratic nominee for the Senate from the state of Massachusetts. She's in a tough race there against a pretty popular incumbent in Scott Brown. She's going to get up tonight and tell us that she grew up on the ragged edge of the middle class, as she puts it, and she's going to make very much a class argument here, very much an economic argument, and argue for why the government needs to have a role in containing and controlling Wall Street.
And Matt Continente, as much as Democrats love her, Republicans really don't.
Not just Republicans, independents. That's why she's losing to Scott Brown by beyond the margin of error in the most recent polls.
But she was a real flashpoint.
Yeah, and the flash is gone.
Capitol Hill.
The flash is gone.
Well,
she's
for
not,
Republicans.
For independents. I mean, she's likely to lose this campaign in Massachusetts, of all places, which shows that maybe her message does not go far beyond the left.
She hasn't lost yet, Matt.
Yeah, well,
and Barack, and she was the race was closer, and I think it will get closer again because President Obama is going to carry my home state of Massachusetts by a very big margin. And Scott Brown is a very good politician. There's no question about it. But he's going to have to take an awful lot of Obama votes to beat Elizabeth Warren.
But Warren did become a bit of a lightning rod in her efforts to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In any case, we're going to hear from the woman herself. Big applause there in Charlotte as she's just been announced. Elizabeth Warren, she's a Harvard Law School professor, Massachusetts Senate candidate. She was talking about the crisis, the economic crisis of middle class long before the recession. Let's listen to Elizabeth Warren.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Warren. Thank you. Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Warren, and this is my first Democratic convention. Enough. I never thought I'd run for the Senate, and I sure never dreamed that I'd be the warm-up act for President Bill Clinton. He's an amazing man who had the good sense to marry one of the coolest women on this planet. I want to give a special shout-out to the Massachusetts delegation. I'm counting on you to help me win and to help President Obama win. I'm here tonight to talk about hardworking people, people who get up early, stay up late, cook dinner, and help out with homework, people who can be counted on to help their kids, their parents, their neighbors, and a lady down the street whose car broke down, people who work their hearts out but are up against a hard truth. The game is rigged against them. It wasn't always this way. Like a lot of you, I grew up in a family on the ragged edges of the middle class. My daddy sold carpeting and ended up as a maintenance man. After he had a heart attack, my mom worked the phones at Sears so we could hang on to our house. All three of my brothers served in the military. One was career. The second, a good union job in construction. And the third started a small business. Me, I was waiting tables at 13 and married at 19. I graduated from public schools and taught elementary school. I have a wonderful husband, two great children, and three beautiful grandchildren. And I'm grateful down to my toes for every opportunity that America gave me. This is a great country. I grew up in an America that invested in its kids and built a strong middle class that allowed millions of children to rise from poverty and establish secure lives. And America that created Social Security and Medicare so that seniors could live with dignity. An America in which each generation built something solid so that the next generation could build something better. But now, for many years, our middle class has been chipped, squeezed, and hammered. Talk to the construction worker I met from Malden, Massachusetts, who went 9 months without finding work. Talk to the head of a manufacturing company in Franklin, trying to protect jobs but worried about rising costs. Talk to the student in Worcester who worked hard to finish his degree, and now he's drowning in debt. Their fight is my fight, and it's Barack Obama's fight, too. That's right. Yes. People feel like the system is rigged against them. And here's the painful part. They're right. The system is rigged. Look around. Oil companies guzzle down billions in profits. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that? Yeah, well, I do too. I do too. I talk to small business owners all across Massachusetts, and not one of them, not one, made big bucks from the risky bets that brought down our economy. I talked to nurses and programmers, salespeople and firefighters, people who bust their tails every day, and not one of them, not one, stashes their money in the Cayman Islands to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. These folks don't resent that someone else made more money. We're Americans. We celebrate success. We just don't want the game to be rigged. We've fought to level the playing field before. About a century ago, when corrosive greed threatened our economy and our way of life, the American people came together under the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt and other progressives to bring our nation back from the brink. We started to take children out of factories and put them in schools. We began to give meaning to the words consumer protection by making food and medicine safe. And we gave the little guys a better chance to compete by preventing the big guys from rigging the markets. We turned adversity into progress because that's what we do.
We're listening to Elizabeth Warren, a Massachusetts Senate candidate.
Americans are fighters. We're tough, resourceful, and creative. And if we have the chance to fight on a level playing field, where everyone pays a fair share and everyone has a real shot, then no one can stop us. President Obama gets it because he's spent his life fighting for the middle class. And now he's fighting to level that playing field because we know the economy doesn't grow from the top down, but from the middle class out and the bottom up. That's how we create jobs and reduce the debt. And Mitt Romney, he wants to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, but for middle-class families who are hanging on by their fingernails, his plan will hammer them with a new tax hike of up to $2,000. Mitt Romney wants to give billions in breaks to big corporations, but he and Paul Ryan would pulverize financial reform, voucherize Medicare, and vaporize Obamacare. The Republican vision is clear. I got mine, the rest of you are on your own. Republicans say they don't believe in government. Sure they do. They believe in government to help themselves and their powerful friends. After all, Mitt Romney's the guy who said, corporations are people. No, Governor Romney, corporations are not people. People have hearts. They have kids. They get jobs. They get sick. They cry. They dance. They live, they love, and they die. And that matters. matters because we don't run this country for corporations. We run it for people. And that's why we need Barack Obama. After the financial crisis, President Obama knew that we had to clean up Wall Street. For years, families had been tricked by credit cards, fooled by student loans, and cheated on mortgages. I had an idea for a Consumer Financial Protection Agency to stop the ripoffs. Now, the big banks sure didn't like it, and they marshaled one of the biggest lobbying forces on earth to destroy the agency before it ever saw the light of day. American families didn't have an army of lobbyists on our side. What we had was a president. President Obama leading the way. And when the lobbyists were closing in for the kill, Barack Obama squared his shoulders, planted his feet, and stood firm. And that's how we won. By the way, just a few weeks ago, that little agency caught one of the biggest credit card companies cheating its customers and made it give people back every penny it took, plus millions of dollars in fines. That's what happens when you have a president on the side of the middle class. President Obama believes in a level playing field. He believes in a country where nobody gets a free ride or a golden parachute, a country where anyone who has a great idea and rolls up their sleeves has a chance to build a business, and anyone who works hard can build some security and raise a family. President Obama believes in a country where billionaires pay their taxes just like their secretaries do. And I can't believe I have to say this in 2012, a country where women get equal pay for equal work.
You're listening to the Democratic National Convention. This is special coverage from NPR News.
He believes in a country where everyone is held accountable, where no one can steal your purse on Main Street or your pension on Wall Street. President Obama believes in a country where we invest in education, in roads and bridges, in science, and in the future, so we can create new opportunities, so the next kid can make it big, and the kid after that, and the kid after that. That's what President Obama believes. And that's how we build the economy of the future, an economy with more jobs and less debt. We root it in fairness, we grow it with opportunity, and we build it together. I grew up in the Methodist Church and taught Sunday school. And one of my favorite passages of Scripture is, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me." Matthew 25:40. The passage teaches about God in each of us, that we are bound to each other, and we are called to act, not to sit, not to wait, but to act. All of us together. Senator Ted Kennedy understood that call. 4 years ago, he addressed our convention for the last time. He said, "We have never lost our belief that we are all called to a better country and a newer world." Generation after generation, Americans have answered that call. And now, we are called again. We are called to restore opportunity for every American. We are called to give America's working families a fighting chance. We are called to build something solid so the next generation can build something better. So let me ask you, America, are you ready to answer this call? Are you ready to fight for good jobs and a strong middle class? Are you ready to work for a level playing field? Are you ready to prove to another generation of Americans that we can build a better country and a newer world? Joe Biden is ready. Barack Obama is ready. I'm ready. You're ready. Thank you. God bless America.
And that was Elizabeth Warren, Harvard Law School professor and Massachusetts Senate candidate, bringing the audience to its feet in Charlotte. She said the system is rigged against hardworking people. She used strong language to criticize Republican ideology, saying that the Republican platform would pulverize financial reform, voucherize Medicare, and vaporize health care reform. And now, Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, is coming to the podium. He's the chair of this convention, and he suggested he might run for governor of California. Antonio Villaraigosa.
Pursuant to our nominating rules, only one candidate is qualified to be the nominee of our party for president of the United States. Our next speaker will place before you that nomination.
Unemployment in June was the highest since March of 1984.
The U.S. economy has been in a recession.
10 million Americans still officially unemployed.
There is nothing wrong with America that cannot.
And this is a video, a retrospective, setting up the speech by Bill Clinton.
We believe that invest and grow economics is better than trickle-down economics. We have got to go beyond the brain-dead politics in Washington and give our people the kind of government they deserve, a government that works for them. After years of hard effort, the longest economic expansion in history, we proved that we could find a way to balance the budget and protect our values.
We have lots of evidence that presidents who focus on the middle class get better results. I personally believe that if the American people give you the honor of serving, you should keep on doing it when you leave office.
I set up this foundation so that I could pursue causes that I could still have an impact on as a private citizen.
It is a results-oriented foundation committed to taking on the world's biggest challenges.
My life has been a balance between fulfilling initiatives that I always wanted and then responding to things that come up.
What should our shared values be? Everybody counts. Everybody deserves a chance. Everybody's got a responsibility to fulfill. We all do better when we work together.
He's helped to create a model for individual responsibility and collective action that all of us are going to be studying for a very long time.
And that was a video.
Ladies and gentlemen,
best hits from Bill Clinton's years.
Clinton.
And he is now coming onto the stage, former President Bill Clinton, the 42nd President of the United States, walking onto the stage of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. The crowd is very excited. I believe this is the campaign theme from 92, if I'm not wrong.
Thank you very much.
Bill Clinton, former president.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, Mr. Mayor, fellow Democrats, we are here to nominate a president. And I've got one in mind. I want to nominate a man whose own life has known its fair share of adversity and uncertainty. I want to nominate a man who ran for president to change the course of an already weak economy, and then just 6 weeks before his election, saw it suffer the biggest collapse since the Great Depression. A man who stopped the slide into depression and put us on the long road to recovery, knowing all the while that no matter how many jobs that he saved or created, there'd still be millions more waiting, worried about feeding their own kids, trying to keep their hopes alive. I want to nominate a man who's cool on the outside. But who burns for America on the inside. I want a man who believes, with no doubt, that we can build a new American dream economy, driven by innovation and creativity, by education, and, yes, by cooperation. And, by the way, after last night, I want a man who had the good sense to marry Michelle Obama. Now, I want Barack Obama to be the next president of the United States. And I proudly nominate him to be the standard bearer of the Democratic Party. Now, folks, in Tampa a few days ago, we heard a lot of talk about how the president and the Democrats don't really believe in free enterprise and individual initiative, how we want everybody to be dependent on the government, how bad we are for the economy. This Republican narrative, its alternative universe, says that every one of us in this room who amounts to anything, we're all completely self-made. One of the greatest chairmen the Democratic Party ever had, Bob Strauss, used to say that every politician wants every voter to believe he was born in a log cabin he built himself. But, as Strauss then admitted, it ain't so. We Democrats, we think the country works better with a strong middle class, with real opportunities for poor folks to work their way into it, with a relentless focus on the future, with business and government actually working together to promote growth and broadly shared prosperity. You see, we believe that we're all in this together is a far better philosophy than you're on your own. Now, so, who's right? Well, since 1961, for 52 years now, the Republicans have held the White House 28 years, the Democrats 24. In those 52 years, our private economy has produced 66 million private sector jobs. So, what's the job score? Republicans, 24 million. Democrats, 42. Now, there's a reason for this. It turns out that advancing equal opportunity and economic empowerment is both morally right and good economics. Why? Because poverty, discrimination, and ignorance restrict growth. When you stifle human potential, when you don't invest in new ideas, it doesn't just cut off the people who are affected, it hurts us all. We know that investments in education and infrastructure and scientific and technological research increase growth. They increase good jobs and they create new wealth for all the rest of us. Now, there's something I've noticed lately. You probably have too. And it's this. Maybe just because I grew up in a different time, but though I often disagree with Republicans, I actually never learned to hate them the way the far right that now controls their party seems to hate our president and a lot of other Democrats. That would be impossible for me because President Eisenhower sent federal troops to my home state to integrate Little Rock Central High School. President Eisenhower built the interstate highway system. When I was a governor, I worked with President Reagan in his White House on the first round of welfare reform and with President George H.W. Bush on national education goals. I'm actually very grateful to, if you saw from the film what I do today, I have to be grateful, and you should be too, that President George W. Bush supported PEPFAR. It saved the lives of millions of people in poor countries. And I have been honored to work with both Presidents Bush on natural disasters in the aftermath of the South Asian tsunami, Hurricane Katrina, the horrible earthquake in Haiti. Through my foundation, both in America and around the world, I'm working all the time with Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. Sometimes I couldn't tell you for the life who I'm working with because we focus on solving problems and seizing opportunities and not fighting all the time. And so here's what I want to say to you, and here's what I want the people at home to think about. When times are tough and people are frustrated and angry and hurting and uncertain, the politics of constant conflict may be good. But what is good politics does not necessarily work in the real world. What works in the real world is cooperation. What works in the real world is cooperation. Business and government, foundations and universities, ask the mayors who are here. Los Angeles is getting green and Chicago is getting an infrastructure bank because Republicans and Democrats are working together to get it. They didn't check their brains at the door. They didn't stop disagreeing, but their purpose was to get something done. Now, why is this true? Why does cooperation work better than constant conflict? Because nobody's right all the time. And a broken clock is right twice a day. And every one of us and every one of them, we're compelled to spend our fleeting lives between those two extremes, knowing we're never going to be right all the time and hoping we're right more than twice a day. Unfortunately, the faction that now dominates the Republican Party doesn't see it that way. They think government is always the enemy, they're always right, and compromise is weakness. Just in the last couple of elections, they defeated two distinguished Republican senators because they dared to cooperate with Democrats on issues important to the future of the country, even national security. They beat a Republican congressman with almost 100% voting record on every conservative score because he said he realized he did not have to hate the president to disagree with him. Boy, that was a non-starter, and they threw him out. One of the main reasons we ought to re-elect President Obama is that he is still committed to constructive cooperation. Look at his record. Look at his record. Look at his record. He appointed Republican secretaries of defense, the Army, and transportation. He appointed a vice president who ran against him in 2008. And he trusted that vice president to oversee the successful end of the war in Iraq and the implementation of the Recovery Act. And Joe Biden did a great job with both.
We're listening to former President Bill Clinton at the Democratic Convention.
President Obama appointed several members of his cabinet, even though they supported Hillary in the primary. Heck, he even appointed Hillary. I am very proud of her. I am proud of the job she and the national security team have done for America. I am grateful that they have worked together to make us safer and stronger, to build a world with more partners and fewer enemies. I'm grateful for the relationship of respect and partnership she and the president have enjoyed, and the signal that sends to the rest of the world that democracy does not have to be a blood sport. It can be an honorable enterprise that advances the public interest. Now, besides the national security team, I am very grateful to the men and women who served our country in uniform through these perilous times. And I am especially grateful to Michelle Obama and to Joe Biden for supporting those military families while their loved ones were overseas. And for supporting our veterans when they came home. When they come home bearing the wounds of war, or needing help to find education or jobs or housing. President Obama's whole record on national security is a tribute to his strength, to his judgment, and to his preference for inclusion and partnership over partisanship. We need more of it in Washington, D.C. Now, we all know that he also tried to work with congressional Republicans on health care, debt reduction, and new jobs. And that didn't work out so well. But it could have been because, as the Senate Republican leader said in a remarkable moment of candor, 2 full years before the election, their number one priority was not to put America back to work. It was to put the president out of work. Well, wait a minute. Senator, I hate to break it to you, but we're going to keep President Obama on the job.
This is live special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News.
Are you ready for that? Are you willing to work for it? Wait a minute. In Tampa, In Tampa, did y'all watch their convention? I did. In Tampa, the Republican argument against the president re-election was actually pretty simple, pretty snappy. It went something like this. We left him a total mess. He hadn't cleaned it up fast enough, so fire him and put us back in. Now, but they did it well. They looked good. They sounded good. They convinced me that they all loved their families and their children and were grateful they'd been born in America and all that. Really, I'm not being — they did. And this is important. They convinced me they were honorable people who believe what they've said, and they're going to keep every commitment they've made. We just got to make sure the American people know what those commitments are. Because in order to look like an acceptable, reasonable, moderate alternative to President Obama, they just didn't say very much about the ideas they've offered over the last 2 years. They couldn't. Because they want to go back to the same old policies that got us in trouble in the first place. They want to cut taxes for high-income Americans even more than President Bush did. They want to get rid of those pesky financial regulations designed to prevent another crash and prohibit future bailouts. They want to actually increase defense spending over a decade, $2 trillion more than the Pentagon has requested, without saying what they'll spend it on. And they want to make enormous cuts in the rest of the budget, especially programs that help the middle class and poor children. As another president once said, there they go again. Now, I like the argument for President Obama's reelection a lot better. Here it is. He inherited a deeply damaged economy. He put a floor under the crash. He began the long, hard road to recovery and laid the foundation for a modern, more well-balanced economy that will produce millions of good new jobs, vibrant new businesses, and lots of new wealth for innovators. Now, are we where we want to be today? No. Is the president satisfied? Of course not. But are we better off than we were when he took office? Then, listen to this. Listen to this. Everybody's forgotten. Everybody's forgotten. When President Barack Obama took office, the economy was in free fall. It had just shrunk 9.4% of GDP. We were losing 750,000 jobs a month. Are we doing better than that today? The answer is yes. Now look, here's the challenge he faces and the challenge all of you who support him face. I get it. I know it. I've been there. A lot of Americans are still angry and frustrated about this economy. If you look at the numbers, you know employment is growing, banks are beginning to lend again. In a lot of places, housing prices are even beginning to pick up. But too many people do not feel it yet. I had the same thing happen in 1994 and early 95. We could see that the policies were working, that the economy was growing, but most people didn't feel it yet. Thankfully, by 1996, the economy was roaring, everybody felt it, and we were halfway through the longest peacetime expansion in the history of the United States. But, wait. The difference this time is purely in the circumstances. President Obama started with a much weaker economy than I did. Listen to me now. No president, not me, not any of my predecessors, no one could have fully repaired all the damage that he found in just 4 years. Now, but he has laid the foundations for a new, modern, successful economy of shared prosperity. And if you will renew the president's contract, you will feel it. You will feel it. Folks, whether the American people believe what I just said or not, maybe the whole election, I just want you to know that I believe it. With all my heart, I believe it. Now, why do I believe it? I'm fixing to tell you why. I believe it because President Obama's approach embodies the values, the ideas, and the direction America has to take to build the 21st century version of the American dream, a nation of shared opportunities, shared responsibilities, shared prosperity, a shared sense of community. So let's get back to the story. In 2010, as the president's recovery program kicked in, the job losses stopped, and things began to turn around. The Recovery Act saved or created millions of jobs and cut taxes — let me say this again — cut taxes for 95% of the American people. And in the last 29 months, our economy has produced about 4.5 million private sector jobs. We could have done better, but last year the Republicans blocked the president's job plan, costing the economy more than 1 million new jobs. So here's another job score. President Obama plus 4.5 million. Congressional Republicans, zero. During this period, more than 500,000 manufacturing jobs have been created under President Obama. That's the first time manufacturing jobs have increased since the 1990s. And I'll tell you something else. The auto industry restructuring worked. It saved more than 1 million jobs, and not just at GM, Chrysler, and their dealerships, but in auto parts manufacturing all over the country. That's why even the automakers who weren't part of the deal supported it. They needed to save those parts suppliers, too. Like I said, we're all in this together. So what's happened? There are now 250,000 more people working in the auto industry than on the day the companies were restructured. So, now we all know that Governor Romney opposed the plan to save GM and Chrysler. So, here's another job score. Are you listening in Michigan and Ohio and across the country? Here's another job score. Obama, 250,000. Romney, zero. Now, the agreement the administration made with the management, labor, and environmental groups to double car mileage, that was a good deal, too. It will cut your gas prices in half, your gas bill. No matter what the price is, if you double the mileage of your car, your bill will be half what it would have been. It will make us more energy independent. It will cut greenhouse gas emissions. And according to several analyses over the next 20 years, it'll bring us another 500,000 good new jobs into the American economy.
You've been listening to special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News.
The president's energy strategy, which he calls all of the above, is helping, too. The boom in oil and gas production, combined with greater energy efficiency, has driven oil imports to a near 20-year low and natural gas production to an all-time high. And renewable energy production has doubled. Of course, we need a lot more new jobs. But there are already more than 3 million jobs open and unfilled in America, mostly because the people who apply for them don't yet have the required skills to do them. So even as we get Americans more jobs, we have to prepare more Americans for the new jobs that are actually going to be created. The old economy is not coming back. We've got to build a new one and educate people to do those jobs. The president and his education secretary have supported community colleges and employers in working together to train people for jobs that are actually open in their communities. And even more important, after a decade in which exploding college costs have increased the dropout rate so much that the percentage of our young people with four-year college degrees has gone down so much that we have dropped to 16th in the world in the percentage of young people with college degrees. So, the president's student loan reform is more important than ever. Here's what it does. You need to tell every voter where you live about this. It lowers the cost of federal student loans, and even more important, it gives students the right to repay those loans as a clear, fixed, low percentage of their income for up to 20 years. Now, what does this mean? Think of it. It means no one will ever have to drop out of college again for fear they can't repay their debt. And it means that if someone wants to take a job with a modest income, a teacher, a police officer, if they want to be a small-town doctor in a little rural area, they won't have to turn those jobs down because they don't pay enough to repay the debt. Their debt obligation will be determined by their salary. This will change the future for young Americans. I don't know about you, but on all these issues, I know we're better off because President Obama made the decisions he did. Now, that brings me to health care. Now, the Republicans call it derisively Obamacare. They say it's a government takeover, a disaster, and that if we'll just elect them, they'll repeal it. Well, are they right?
No.
Let's take a look at what's actually happened so far. First, individuals and businesses have already gotten more than $1 billion in refunds from insurance companies because the new law requires 80 to 85% of your premium to go to your health care, not profits or promotion. And the gains are even greater than that because a bunch of insurance companies have applied to lower their rates to comply with the requirement. Second, more than 3 million young people between 19 and 25 are insured for the first time because their parents' policies can cover them. Third, millions of seniors are receiving preventive care, all the way from breast cancer screenings to tests for heart problems and scores of other things. And younger people are getting them, too. Fourth, soon the insurance companies, not the government, the insurance companies will have millions of new customers, many of them middle-class people with pre-existing conditions who never could get insurance before. Now, finally, listen to this. For the last 2 years, after going up at three times the rate of inflation for a decade, health care costs have been under 4% in both years for the first time in 50 years. So, let me ask you something. Are we better off because President Obama fought for health care reform? You bet we are. Now, there were two other attacks on the president in Tampa I think deserve an answer. First, both Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan attacked the president for allegedly robbing Medicare of $716 billion. That's the same attack they leveled against the Congress in 2010. And they got a lot of votes on it. But it's not true. Look, here's what really happened. You be the judge. Here's what really happened. There were no cuts to benefits at all. None. What the president did was to save money by taking the recommendations of a commission of professionals to cut unwarranted subsidies to providers and insurance companies that were not making people healthier and were not necessary to get the providers to provide the service. And instead of raiding Medicare, he used the savings to close the donut hole in the Medicare drug program. And you all got to listen carefully to this. This is really important. And to add 8 years to the life of the Medicare Trust Fund so it is solvent till 2024. So, President Obama and the Democrats didn't weaken Medicare, they strengthened Medicare. Now, when Congressman Ryan looked into that TV camera and attacked President Obama's Medicare savings as, quote, the biggest, coldest power play, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Because that $716 billion is exactly to the dollar the same amount of Medicare savings that he has in his own budget. You got to give one thing. It takes some brass to attack a guy for doing what you did. Now, you're having a good time, but this is getting serious. I want you to listen. It's important, because a lot of people believe this stuff. Now, at least on this issue, and this one issue, Governor Romney has been consistent. He attacked President Obama, too. But he actually wants to repeal those savings and give the money back to the insurance company. He wants to go back to the old system, which means we'll reopen the donut hole and force seniors to pay more for drugs, and we'll reduce the life of the Medicare Trust Fund by 8 full years. So, if he's elected, and if he does what he promised to do, Medicare will now grow broke in 2016. Think about that. That means, after all, we won't have to wait until our voucher program kicks in 2023 to see the end of Medicare as we know it. They're going to do it to us sooner than we thought. Now, folks, this is serious because it gets worse. And you won't be laughing when I finish telling you this. They also want to block grant Medicaid and cut it by a third over the coming 10 years. Of course, that's going to really hurt a lot of poor kids. But that's not all.
A lot of folks don't know it, but nearly two-thirds of Medicaid is spent on nursing home care for Medicare seniors who are eligible for Medicaid. It's going to end Medicare as we know it. And a lot of that money is also spent to help people with disabilities, including a lot of middle-class families whose kids have Down syndrome or autism or other severe conditions. And honestly, just think about it. If that happens, I don't know what those families are going to do. So I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do everything I can to see that it doesn't happen. We can't let it happen. We can't. Now, wait a minute. Let's look at the other big charge the Republicans made. It's a real doozy. They actually have charged and run ads saying that President Obama wants to weaken the work requirements in the welfare reform bill I signed that moved millions of people from welfare to work. Wait, you need to know, here's what happened. Nobody ever tells you what really happened. Here's what happened. When some Republican governors asked if they could have waivers to try new ways to put people on welfare back to work, the Obama administration listened, because we all know it's hard for even people with good work histories to get jobs today, so moving folks from welfare to work is a real challenge. And the administration agreed to give waivers to those governors and others only if they had a credible plan to increase employment by 20%, and they could keep the waivers only if they did increase employment. Now, did I make myself clear? The requirement was for more work, not less. So, this is personal to me. We moved millions of people off welfare. It was one of the reasons that in the 8 years I was president, we had 100 times as many people move out of poverty into the middle class than happened under the previous 12 years. 100 times as many. It's a big deal. But I am telling you, the claim that President Obama weakened welfare reform's work requirement is just not true. But they keep on running ads claiming it. You want to know why? Their campaign poster said, "We are not going to let our campaign be dictated by fact checkers." Now, finally, I can say that is true. I couldn't have said it better myself. And I hope you and every American within the sound of my voice remembers it every time they see one of those ads and it turns into an ad to reelect Barack Obama and keep the fundamental principles of personal empowerment and moving everybody who can get a job into work as soon as we can. Now, let's talk about the debt. Today, interest rates are low, lower than the rate of inflation. People are practically paying us to borrow money, hold their money for them. But it will become a big problem when the economy grows and interest rates start to rise. We've got to deal with this big long-term debt problem, or it will deal with us. It'll gobble up a bigger and bigger percentage of the federal budget we'd rather spend on education and health care and science and technology. We've got to deal with it. Now, what has the president done? He has offered a reasonable plan of $4 trillion in debt reduction over a decade, with $2.5 trillion coming from for every $2.5 trillion in spending cuts, he raises a dollar in new revenues, 2.5 to 1. And he has tight controls on future spending. That's the kind of balanced approach proposed by the Simpson-Bowles Commission, a bipartisan commission. Now, I think this plan is way better than Governor Romney's plan. First, the Romney plan fails the first test of fiscal responsibility. The numbers just don't add up. I mean, consider this. What would you do if you had this problem? Somebody says, oh, we got a big debt problem, we got to reduce the debt. So what's the first thing he says we're going to do? Well, to reduce the debt, we're going to have another $5 trillion in tax cuts, heavily weighted to upper-income people. So we'll make the debt hole bigger before we start to get out of it. Now, when you say, what are you going to do about this $5 trillion you just added on? They say, oh, we'll make it up by eliminating loopholes in the tax code. So then you ask, well, which loopholes and how much? You know what they say? See me about that after the election. I'm not making it up. That's their position. See me about that after the election. Now, people ask me all the time how we got 4 surplus budgets in a row. What new ideas did we bring to Washington? I always give a one-word answer. Arithmetic. If they stay with this $5 trillion tax cut plan in a debt reduction plan, the arithmetic tells us, no matter what they say, one of 3 things is about to happen. One, assuming they try to do what they say they'll do, get rid of, cover it by deductions, cutting those deductions. One, they'll have to eliminate so many deductions, like the ones for home mortgages and charitable giving, that middle-class families will see their tax bills go up an average of $2,000, while anybody who makes $3 million or more will see their tax bill go down $250,000. Or, two, they'll have to cut so much spending that they'll obliterate the budget for the national parks, for ensuring clean air, clean water, safe food, safe air travel. They'll cut way back on Pell Grants, college loans, early childhood education, child nutrition programs, all the programs that help to empower middle-class families and help poor kids. Oh, they'll cut back on investments in roads and bridges and science and technology and biomedical research. That's what they'll do. They'll hurt the middle class and the poor and put the future on hold to give tax cuts to upper-income people who've been getting it all along. Or three, in spite of all the rhetoric, they'll just do what they've been doing for more than 30 years. They'll go on and cut the taxes way more than they cut spending, especially with that big defense increase, and they'll just explode the debt and weaken the economy. And they'll destroy the federal government's ability to help you by letting interest gobble up all your tax payments. Don't you ever forget, when you hear them talking about this, that Republican economic policies quadrupled the national debt before I took office, in the 12 years before I took office. And double the debt in the 8 years after I left, because it defied arithmetic. It was a highly inconvenient thing for them in our debates that I was just a country boy from Arkansas and I came from a place where people still thought 2 and 2 was 4. It's arithmetic. We simply cannot afford to give the reins of government to someone who will double down on trickle down.
And we're listening to former President Bill Clinton.
Think about this. President Obama President Obama's plan cuts the debt, honors our values, brightens the future of our children, our families, and our nations. It's a heck of a lot better. It passes the arithmetic test, and far more important, it passes the values test. My fellow Americans, all of us in this grand hall, and everybody watching at home, when we vote in this election, we'll be deciding what kind of country we want to live in. If you want a winner-take-all, you're on your own society, you should support the Republican ticket. But if you want a country of shared opportunities and shared responsibility, a we're-all-in-this-together society, you should vote for Barack Obama and Joe Biden. If you want every American to vote, and you think it is wrong to change voting procedures, just to reduce the turnout of younger, poorer, minority, and disabled voters, you should support Barack Obama. And if you think the president was right to open the doors of American opportunity to all those young immigrants brought here when they were young so they can serve in the military or go to college, you must vote for Barack Obama. If you want a future of shared prosperity, where the middle class is growing and poverty is declining, where the American dream is really alive and well again, and where the United States maintains its leadership as a force for peace and justice and prosperity in this highly competitive world, you have to vote for Barack Obama. Look, I love our country so much, and I know we're coming back. For more than 200 years, through every crisis, we've always come back. People have predicted our demise ever since George Washington was criticized for being a mediocre surveyor with a bad set of wooden false teeth. And so far, every single person that's bet against America has lost money, because we always come back. We come through every fire a little stronger and a little better. And we do it because in the end we decide to champion the cause for which our founders pledged their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, the cause of forming a more perfect union. My fellow Americans, if that is what you want, if that is what you believe, you must vote and you must reelect President Barack Obama. God bless you and God bless America.
And that was former President Bill Clinton giving a passionate defense of President Obama. He has the crowd on their feet there. Mr. Clinton said, "We believe we're all in this together" is a far better philosophy than you're on your own. And now President Obama has come out. And he and former President Clinton have hugged, standing arms around each other. There's a chance of four more years. They're still playing Bill Clinton's old campaign music there. Former President Clinton said that no president, not even him, could have fully repaired the damage that Mr. Obama found in the economy when he took office.
but that he laid the foundation for a modern economy and shared prosperity. He went through point by point defending Mr. Obama's policies and criticizing Republican policies. He said, we cannot afford to give the reins to someone who will double down on trickle down. And he said, America always comes back. We're joined now by NPR's Ron Elving and Mara Liasson. We have E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and Matt Continenti of The Washington Free Beacon. Ron Elving, he's good, Bill Clinton. He had a great time tonight.
If there were anyone wondering if Bill Clinton had lost a step in a dozen years out of office, they got their answer tonight. So this was an analytical breakdown of everything that's before this convention. The Republican convention from last week, the Obama case with pluses and minuses, the differences in vision between the parties, and the choice in November. And it was all delivered with that incisiveness of Bill Clinton's intellect, but also with, shall we say, a full dose of the folksy Bill Clinton, the charming Bill Clinton, to keep the audience with you any way you can, Bill Clinton. He was in full form tonight.
EJ, he also gave one of the harshest attacks we've heard on congressional Republicans.
Yes, indeed. I mean, first of all, this was so classic Clinton. He called himself the country boy from Arkansas, and he was rambling yet focused. He embroidered his text with folksy asides. He got the crowd to cheer budget numbers and statistics. he went long, and they wanted longer. And yes, he went straight at the congressional Republicans. He went at the Republicans on a lot of fronts. He basically was saying, you know, if there is stuff that hasn't been passed, it's because they were obstructors. If what Ryan said, he went after the vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, for attacking budget cuts in Medicare and then using those cuts in his own budgets. And he said it takes brass. This was added to his text. It takes brass to attack someone who is doing what you're doing. This was just, if you missed Bill Clinton, you got a great dose of him tonight.
Mara Liasson, you covered the Bill Clinton White House. What'd you make of his talk?
Yeah, I thought this was pretty classic Clinton. It was really a tour de force. He spoke for almost 50 minutes. And it was a methodical and comprehensive dismantling of the Republican argument that they laid out in Tampa. I think that it was full of facts and it was full of analysis. And he did it with that kind of aw shucks humor that he's famous for. I think he made a very good case for President Obama. He came to his defense, particularly when his own programs were being attacked, especially the welfare argument that the Republicans have been making. And I haven't heard the president or really any member of the White House rebut that as effectively as former President Clinton did tonight. He also, I think, tried to turn the argument of the Republicans on its head. The Republicans said in Tampa, we're going to give you permission to fire someone that you really like and that you found inspiring 4 years ago, but it's okay. You can get rid of him because he's been disappointing and he hasn't delivered. What President Clinton said tonight is the president satisfied with how things are right now? Of course not. But are we better off than we were in the midst of the financial crisis? Of course we are. He says, I know Americans are still angry and frustrated. They don't feel the improvement in the economy. But if you stick with this president, I promise you that things are going to get better. And I think that he said, I believe this with all my heart. I believe in Barack Obama. And I think he's arguing that people should, too.
Matt Continenti, yeah. Hang on. We'll come right back to you. Let's just dip in there. Starting the official roll call to put Mr. Obama in the nomination.
Have publicly delivered their vote because we know that every state counts and every vote is precious. Tonight we renominate our friend, leader, and America's president, Barack Obama. So let us begin. Alabama. Alabama, you have 69 votes.
Madam Secretary, I am Joe Reed, chair of the Alabama delegation representing the great state of Alabama. The state where the 1965 Voting Rights Act, where the seeds were planted and nurtured by blood, sweat, and tears. Alabama has more black elected officials per capita than any state in the nation. Where the right to vote is worth dying for. A state where the Republicans have a grand design to suppress, dilute, undermine, and eliminate the right to vote. That, too, Alabamians and others are ready to fight for. We now have the opportunity to present to this nation 69 votes for the next president of the United States, our current president, the Honorable Barack Obama. Thank you.
Thank you. Alabama cast.
Okay, that's the official roll call going on there at the convention. Obama. Debbie Elliott is on the floor, and NPR's Debbie Elliott. Hi there.
Hi, I'm still in Ohio. The Secret Service had things shut down because I think they knew that President Obama was going to make a surprise appearance tonight. And I'm with Joyce Beatty. She is a candidate for Congress in a new district from Ohio. She's from Columbus. And she was on her feet a good part of President Clinton's speech. What did you think tonight?
I thought he was outstanding. And when they say you save the best for last, he truly was that. Tonight we heard a strong message, a message about cooperation and not conflict, a message that really told us why we should re-elect President Barack Obama for a second time. And I think it was very clear. When you look at his accomplishment, for me, it was real important to hear him say, not only could not President Barack Obama, nor President Clinton, nor any of his predecessors be able to clean up something that had been so bad, and that it is usually in the second term that someone is to be able to make a difference. So when you hear someone say, we messed it up, you didn't clean it up soon enough, so put us back in it. But I think he painted a true picture of a man that came into office and that has done so many things. And oftentimes, we don't say the things that we've done, but tonight, President Clinton shared with us from one president to another president what we've done in the economy, what we have done for families, and the comparative analysis that he provided for us, I think to this audience, left us with a clear impression of all the successes.
You know, you, the delegates, you know, you knew some of the stuff he said, but tonight was not President Clinton speaking to a broader audience? I mean, do you feel like he was reaching out to those voters who may be believing some of the campaign rhetoric that's been going on? Do you think he made the case that might resonate with, in fact, those Ohio voters who are on the fence?
Well, clearly, I think tonight, not only did he make the case, he backed up the case, and I think he spoke to the world. We just happen to be inside this facility. But I think as an American, as someone who's going to vote, that cares about the economy, there's no political face on that. So tonight what he did was he spoke to America. He spoke to the people to let them know that we need to give President Obama a second chance by re-electing him so he can finish the job of continuing to make this a better place for us.
What kind of a message did it send when President Obama came out and the two men embraced? You know, you can't help think about 4 years ago, there was a bit of a different attitude between those two men.
Well, I think he started it and ended it the same. When he started by saying he appointed a vice president who had been a candidate, he had appointed people to the cabinet who had not been with them. And heck, he appointed his wife, Hillary Clinton. So he began with that, the embracement of two of the most powerful men in our country. To me, that was that solidified that they stand together, they're united, And if we look at what they've both done, we'd be in a better place.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
That was Joyce Beatty. She is a candidate for Congress, a Democratic candidate for Congress in Ohio, a new district in the Columbus area. Jennifer?
Thanks, NPR's Debbie Elliott. Matt Continenti, let's come back to you for your take on Bill Clinton's 50-minute speech there.
Well, like everybody, I thought it was an effective speech, and I think the whole point of the speech actually came after Bill Clinton concluded, which was when President Obama made his surprise appearance. And it was very important for the Obama campaign to link the current incumbent with President Clinton and President Clinton's record and President Clinton's legacy. Now, why is that? It's because Obama is having trouble running on his record and running on his legacy, that he has to now appeal to someone who was first elected president 20 years ago.
But do you think Clinton made a good case for the past 4 years?
Yeah, if you like Bill Clinton, he made a you know, excellent explanation and had his facts, had his figures, you know, it had the sense of humor. I mean, I like the guy, so what can you say? I will say this, though. Clinton has been a surrogate since he left office 12 years ago for many Democratic politicians, and he's not a very successful one. And among those politicians include his own wife, who he supported pretty vociferously, if you recall, 4 years ago. Didn't get her elected, didn't get Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett elected, nor Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, nor his best friend Terry McAuliffe when he ran for the Democratic nomination in Virginia. So didn't get his vice president, Al Gore, elected in 2000. So a spotty record of being a surrogate, highly, you know, persuasive one at the time, very popular. Whether that carries over to the person he's championing, I think, is always up in the air.
Ron Elving, Clinton used a word you don't hear a lot on the campaign trail, the word hate. And he talked about how he does not hate Republicans like he feels some Republicans today hate the president. And he talked about how he'd worked with them over the years.
You know, let's bring it back to the 1990s. This is the Bill Clinton that was impeached by the House of Representatives in 1998, acquitted by the Senate, but impeached by the House, and there were a great number of members of the House who were driving for that impeachment process, who, it would have to be said, expressed some hateful moments, at least, against Bill Clinton. And we don't have to go through all of the scandals, all of the escapades, all of the things that marred the Clinton record back in the 90s to remember that he was a man with flaws. But they had a kind of modus operandi. There was a working relationship between him and the Republicans running the Congress. Even though they impeached him, even though he came to the brink of being removed from office, they had a working relationship. They got budgets done. They actually put restraints on spending. They actually made the budget deficit decline. Now, of course, they had a good economy, but they had a good economy despite having done some fairly tough things like raise taxes in 1993. And that all kind of came together by the end at 2000. Perhaps there was a little bit of Bill Clinton fatigue there that hurt Al Gore in the 2000 election. But all of the policy summary of the 90s, when you look back on it, whether you're a conservative looking at the welfare law changes or if you're a liberal looking at some of the other things that happened during that period of time, you'd have to say the country moved forward in the 90s, and it was largely through cooperation between the parties, Bill Clinton and the Republican leaders of the House.
All right, we're going to come back in a few moments, and we'll have more analysis of not just former President Bill Clinton's speech, but another powerful speech from Elizabeth Warren. You are listening to special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News. This is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. We just heard the most rousing speech of the convention so far. Former President Bill Clinton spoke for 50 minutes. He systematically took on all of the arguments made by Republicans last week in Tampa, and he defended the president's record on the economy, hammering at the GOP in his traditionally folksy style. On the floor of the convention in Charlotte now, we have the official roll call taking place. Let's listen in. This is Delaware.
Peter Spencer and the home of Dr. Jill Biden and the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden. The Delaware delegation proudly cast its 33 votes for the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Delaware. Delaware cast 33 votes for Barack Obama. Democrats abroad representing Democrats living all over the world, you have 19 votes.
Madam Secretary, Democrats abroad represents many of the estimated 6 million American citizens living outside of the United States. Our members come from every congressional district in the United States. For instance, I live in Canada, but I vote absentee in Buffalo, New York. Our delegation here tonight comes from 5 countries. We register voters on our website, votefromabroad.org. Available in English and Spanish. Tell your family and friends who are living abroad to go to votefromabroad.org, request an absentee ballot, and make their vote count. Madam Secretary, Democrats Abroad is proud to cast its 18 and a half delegation votes for President Barack Obama.
Thank you, Democrats Abroad. Democrats Abroad cast 18.5 votes for Barack Obama. District of Columbia, you have 45 votes.
Madam Secretary, I introduce to the Democrats of this assembly, Mayor Vincent C. Gray, our mayor governor, who will cast our votes.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I am proud tonight to represent the 618,000 residents of the District of Columbia. At this convention, we have heard about the importance of inclusion, about creating opportunities, about moving forward, about hope for the future, and we certainly have just heard an eloquent presentation about the fallacies in the Republican arguments in this election. What we have heard also are moving stories about what makes America great. We are a city that pays $3.5 billion annually in federal taxes and raises $5.6 billion in local taxes to support our city. Our great nation was founded upon the fundamental principle of resistance to taxation without representation. Yet, we continue to endure that in the District of Columbia. So we ask you, please, America, as we work to re-elect President Obama, work with us to bring justice and equality to the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia proudly cast its entire 43 votes for the re-election of President Barack Obama.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. District of
and
Columbia,
that is the alphabetical roll call of states
Obama.
That at a certain point will cross a threshold and Mr. Obama will be the nominee. Sonari Glinton, NPR Sonari Glinton, is down there among the crowds on the floor. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, Jennifer, I'm here with a couple of cheeseheads who are from
Must Green be Wisconsin.
Bay. Yes, Green Bay, Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. I'm with Nancy Schleiss, and I get a bonus if I get this right. Patty Philbrick Linsmeyer, right?
You get a bonus.
Right, I got it right?
Right, you got it.
Now you, Ms. Schleiss, you were tearing up during President Clinton's speech. What did you think of it?
I thought it was just fabulous. I hope every independent was listening, every possibly Republican listening, because he did such an incredible job of articulating what all of us Democrats already know, that if Barack Obama is elected, our country will continue to move forward. We will be able to retain all the health benefits that we're getting. And if the Republicans get elected, we're headed in a wrong direction.
Now Ms. Philbrick Linsmeyer,
right.
You were saying to me earlier that it's been a hard couple of years for Democrats in Wisconsin. I mean, how do you see that? Do you see that changing?
I do. I mean, I think that we're growing our party locally. I think Wisconsin has always taken politics seriously. And I think that people are recognizing how important this election is. We need to keep everything on track. We need to continue to move forward. We've seen some of the damage already moving backward with Governor Scott Walker, and we're not going to let it happen again.
And how do you feel about the turnout?
Oh, here?
Turnout in Green Bay in Wisconsin.
Our turnout is usually very good, but we work every day to increase it with membership, voter registration, get out the vote. We have a wonderful staff in Green Bay. We really, really do, and they work hard, and we work for them.
All right, I'm going to send it back up to Jennifer in Washington. Thank you. Go Bears.
Go Packers.
Getting causing some ruckus down there, NPR Sonora Glinton. Ron Elving, let's go back a little bit, and I'd love to get everyone's thoughts on Elizabeth Warren, who is a Harvard law professor who's quite a compelling speaker of her own on the stump there. She's running for the Senate in Massachusetts against Scott Brown, who won the seat in a special election back in January 2010. It's a pretty close race there. This is the seat that was held for 46 years by the so-called Liberal Lion Senator Ted Kennedy. How did Elizabeth Warren do, Ron?
Elizabeth Warren gave a more effective speech here tonight in this venue and with this audience and with this subject, in other words, Barack Obama, than she has been able to do thus far, generally speaking. I don't want to characterize each speaking opportunity she's had in Massachusetts, but generally speaking, tonight was more effective for her than her campaign has been. She's had some low points, struggling with her identification as an American Indian at one point and so on. This has not been what a lot of people hoped it would be, an easy campaign in which a clear Democrat and a champion of Democratic values would win in a Democratic state and sweep Scott Brown and the memory of his winning Teddy Kennedy's seat out of their memories. That has not been what's happened. She has not been as effective as they hoped, and I imagine there are a number of people here from Massachusetts tonight who are hoping this will represent some sort of rebirth of her campaign.
Matt Continente, she had pretty strong language. She said the game is rigged. She said Republicans say they don't like government involvement, but they do to help them and their powerful friends.
Yes, and she basically charged Mitt Romney of tax avoidance, saying that he was sending money to the Cayman Islands to escape taxes, which that's just not true.
It's not clear. We don't know if that's true, Matt.
Well,
I don't know, but it's
we not, had four. We had four primetime speeches, right? And I think if you had to rank them, it would be Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, Julian Castro, and Elizabeth Warren would come at the bottom. I don't think it was the crowd loved it, clearly, but I don't think it was as effective an appeal to independence as the other three.
EJ?
Yeah, I disagree. I think Ron described the trajectory of her campaign correctly. She was very strong at the beginning. She had a strong voice. She was up in the polls. People saw her as a plain-spoken truth teller as opposed to a Harvard professor. And then her campaign has run into a lot of troubles. And I have a hunch that, Matt noted correctly that she's down about 5 points in the polls. I think she picked up a couple of those tonight. Two things in particular. One, there was just some very straightforward talk. She defended government, as Democrats have done over and over again, for giving the little guys a better chance to compete. by preventing the big guys from rigging the markets. And it was also very good that she did something else. Most people don't know Elizabeth Warren is a religious woman, and her religious faith has actually inspired her in this. That might help her with a lot of the swing independence Matt's talking about. She made a point of bringing it up, noting that she had taught Sunday school, and she cited her favorite passage of scripture, one of mine too, Matthew 25:40, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of these, the least of my brethren, ye have done it unto me. And that is really what she's about.
All right, we're going to dip back down to the floor there where the roll call of states is taking place. I believe we have Illinois up now.
Strong to create the brightest possible future for our children and to turn our red state to blue.
Actually, this is Idaho.
We Idahoans proudly cast all 31 votes for our president, the next president of the United States, Barack Obama.
Idaho cast 31 votes for Barack Obama. Thank you. Illinois, where the president has served so ably as your senator, you have 215 votes.
Madam Secretary, Illinois, the land of Lincoln, in the land of President Barack Obama. The land of United States Senator Dick Durbin, Governor Pat Quinn, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Secretary of State Jesse White, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, Lieutenant Governor Sheila Simon, Senate President John Cullerton. Woo! Illinois, in November, will send 6 new members to the United States House of Representatives. These people will vote for Nancy Pelosi to become the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. Illinois will send Tammy Duckworth, Brad Schneider, Bill Foster, Bill Enyard, David Gill, Sherry Bustos. Illinois is proud to cast its 196 votes for a son of Illinois, the President of the United States, and the next President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you, Speaker Madigan. Illinois.
All right, that's part of the roll call of the Democratic Convention. NPR's Debbie Elliott is on the floor down in Charlotte. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Holding up?
I am. I made it over to the Arkansas delegation. The seats are starting to empty out here. They've already cast their votes. But I was watching them from afar during President Clinton's speech. And they were on their feet practically the entire time. And I've got a lone delegate who stayed around to talk with me. Her name is Clementine Bass. She's from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And she's got a very proud look on her face.
I'm very proud. I'm very proud of our Governor, President Clinton. And I'm very happy to be here to elect Barack Obama as our next president of the United States.
What did you think of President Clinton's speech tonight?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, it was like we were home and he was telling us a story, and it was very vivid. I enjoyed it. I really did.
Now, I understand that you have been a supporter of Bill Clinton for several years now.
Yes, I passed flyers out for him when he was running for the second term of the governor of Arkansas. And I passed flyers out. I didn't know what I was doing, but that's when I gained the love for politics.
And you said you were 12 years old at the time?
I was 12 years old at the time. And they asked me to do it, and I just enjoyed it. And I love politics ever since then.
Now you're a delegate here. What do you think President Clinton's speech does for the candidacy of President Obama?
I think President Clinton laid the foundation for another 4 years for President Obama, because what he told us is what we need to know as voters so we can be aware of what's really going on.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, NPR's Debbie Elliott. Mara Liasson, looking ahead to tomorrow night, what's left for President Obama to do now?
Well, he has plenty left to do. He has to really tell the country what a second Obama term would be. What are his goals? I mean, we've certainly heard the case laid out for why Mitt Romney would be bad for the United States. We've also heard a vigorous defense of the Obama record, why we actually are, in the Democrats' view, better off today than we were 4 years ago, why we're going in the right direction, why it's important not to go backwards. But what exactly does that mean? What are the big goals of the second term? What does he want to do? I think that's what's still left to be written, and it's up to him to do it.
Matt Continenti, what will you be listening for?
Exactly what Mara said. I mean, it's a mystery to me, too. And we've heard some airy promises of an immigration reform. We've heard about, another try of maybe at a cap-and-trade bill. All of those require the type of cooperation that President Clinton talked about. And that sort of cooperation I just don't see forthcoming from most likely a reelected House Republican majority and perhaps even more Republicans in the Senate.
EJ?
I think what you're going to hear tomorrow night from Obama are a lot of specifics about what he's going to do. I think he's going to use the opening provided by Romney's vagueness to paint a picture of here's where I want to move. I think he is going to talk about immigration reform. He is going to talk about energy. I think he'll talk a lot about education. And I think he'll try to build on the critique that Clinton offered. Clinton knocked down a lot of the Republican arguments. He was almost the blocking back for Obama tomorrow night. He won't have to be harsh. He won't have to answer certain things that Clinton did, although it wouldn't surprise me if he cited his best witness for the defense, which is what Clinton was tonight.
All right, Ron Elving, quick last word.
I do believe he will speak of what Bill Clinton spoke of tonight, and he will make specific reference to some of the things Clinton said. In general, he'll try to be what Michelle Obama was to Ted Strickland's speech on the first night. He'll try to be the softer side, the more charming side, if you will, the more accepting and open-armed person, but he will be basically repeating a lot of what we heard from Bill Clinton tonight.
All right. We've wrapped up this evening. We had a stirring speech from former President Bill Clinton, who took the stage to wild applause and laid out the argument for President Obama's reelection. Despite inheriting a weak economy, he said Obama, quote, put a floor under the crash, began the long, hard road to recovery, and laid the foundation for a more modern, more well-balanced economy that will produce millions of good new jobs. Tomorrow night, President Obama takes the podium, and we will bring that to you as well. It will be live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington.